In this episode, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit hears argument in United States v. Gibson, docket number 25-30445. The defendant, Cody Gibson, was convicted of conspiracy to distribute a controlled substance and challenges the sufficiency of the evidence on appeal. The core legal issue is whether the government presented sufficient evidence at trial to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the controlled substance involved in the conspiracy was methamphetamine, as charged in the indictment and found by the jury in a special verdict, rather than some other drug such as marijuana or pills. The government's case rested on wiretapped phone calls using coded language, cash transfer records, and testimony from law enforcement agents about street prices and packaging. Critically, the government never recovered any physical drugs from the transactions involving Gibson, a fact that lies at the heart of the defense argument. The case raises questions about how much inferential evidence is enough when a mandatory minimum sentence hinges on the type of drug proven.
The first case on our docket this morning is 25-30445.
Douglas Lee Harville now begins the argument for the defendant, Cody Gibson.
United States versus Gibson. Mr. Harville.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Douglas Lee Harville with Harville Law Firm on behalf of Mr. Cody Gibson. Your Honors, we appreciate you providing us with time today in this case, which I think has importance at the trial level, at the plea level, throughout a criminal prosecution. In this case, Mr. Gibson never contended at trial that the evidence was not sufficient to prove a conspiracy, as alleged in count one, but the question was what CDS was involved, what drug. That is where the heart of our challenge lies. We believe, Your Honors, that if you carefully review this record on appeal, that no reasonable juror could have found beyond a reasonable doubt that the government established what controlled substance was involved in any of these transactions underlying counts one.
It's in the indictment. It's meth charged.
It is charged specifically.
And it was a special verdict finding meth.
There was, Your Honor.
Okay, so when the government cites Daniels, why isn't that decisive? In other words,
the panel just mentioned Daniels, a 2013 Fifth Circuit decision that both sides rely on. In that case, the government charged a conspiracy involving 5 kilograms or more of cocaine, but offered only circumstantial evidence of drug quantity. The Fifth Circuit held that while drug type and amount are not elements of the offense itself, they trigger sentencing enhancements and mandatory minimums, so the government must prove them beyond a reasonable doubt to support the jury's special verdict. The court found insufficient evidence in Daniels and remanded for resentencing under a lower drug quantity. Both advocates in this case argue that Daniels controls the outcome here, but they draw opposite conclusions about what the evidence shows.
The type and the amount of the drug is just a sentencing enhancement issue. It doesn't go to guilt.
Your Honor, at 4 counts 1 and 6, it would go toward the need for this court to come back with a lesser included if you accept the government's argument. And the reason for that is whenever you trigger the methamphetamine conspiracy, you are having the jury and you're saying that the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt enough to impose, in this case, a 5-year mandatory minimum, but for the way that the government charged the matter, a 10-year. And when you look at what the government actually proved, it may not be an element, but it's very important to the sentence involved.
But you aren't attacking the sentence. You didn't object to the PSR, which goes far above 5 grams, goes to 28 grams. There was no objection to the PSR amount, and there was no objection to the sentence. And the brief is not a sentencing, as I understand it. You're not making a sentencing.
Right. No, I'm not, Your Honor. The government is correct in that if you accept my argument, you would have to find, because they didn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt what was alleged in the indictment, the methamphetamine. My argument is they did not prove that beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right. And My counterpoint is, in your brief on page 12, you admit they did prove drug transfer.
Yes.
So I guess I'm struggling with how that becomes a guilt issue if we look at drug type and amount at sentencing, but you didn't object at sentencing.
Your Honor, I think it is a further, when you look at what this court decided in Daniels, that you have to, the government, to get the guilty as found to sustain that verdict. The government has to meet its proof to the, not only in that case, the type and quantity of drugs.
Wait, isn't that more of a variance argument? They charge meth, but they prove something else? But anyway, yeah. Okay, so if it is an issue of sufficiency, their response is there was the remark about it.
One judge floats the idea of a variance argument. In criminal law, a variance occurs when the proof at trial diverges from what was alleged in the indictment. If the indictment charges methamphetamine, but the evidence shows only marijuana or an unspecified drug, that mismatch can be a variance. A fatal variance violates the defendant's right to notice of the charges. Defense counsel seems to argue that even if this is framed as insufficient evidence, it might also be understood as a variance problem. Though the core claim remains that the government simply failed to prove methamphetamine beyond a reasonable doubt.
ICE, there was the box size that only fixed meth, right? Those were the two principal. On January 18, we know it was a meth deal because the box that was used is a meth box.
Well, Your Honor, the box that was used is not a meth box. It was a carton of, appeared to be what would be a carton of cigarettes, hard carton of cigarettes. The government's argument is that based on their, as I say, cryptic and uncertain references to price, because if you look through this as well, this
well, price is different. They had three prongs to why they think the jury had enough to make the inference it did.
Yes, sir.
One is the 350 is the value of meth, not marijuana. Two is the box size. Three is the term ICE. The agent testified that in the wiretap meant meth.
Well, Your Honor, the agent, just to be clear, though, the agent testifying ICE meaning meth was never in relationship to a call regarding Mr. Gibson. That was with other defendants in this case. And I think that that's what...
That's really important. I agree. I thought that that argument of yours was maybe more correct for the dollar amounts, but I thought the ICE remark was specifically... What's his name? Carney? Is that his name?
Dimitri Carey.
Carey.
Yes.
I thought it was Carey talking about the January 18th sale. You're saying it wasn't?
Oh, okay. No, and I'm sorry, Your Honor. That phone call is a phone call that was made after this alleged transaction.
Referring back in time to the 18th sale.
Right, but the problem, though, in that he talks about selling marijuana. There's a reference to pills, and there's methamphetamine. And the total dollar amount, I believe that he had said he made over a band, which the government testified would be about $1,000. The government's argument was that he was paid $400 for a prior marijuana sale, that he was paid $300 for a methamphetamine sale, which he tries to shoehorn into Mr. Gibson, and then there's that $300 that would have been for pills. The problem, Your Honor, is this. Your Honors know, I know from practicing, there are different variants of marijuana. There are different grades of marijuana. Some marijuana for an ounce may be 300, some may be several thousand. It depends. The problem that I have in this case, and why I think that this is important, and why I don't think the government meets its burden beyond reasonable doubt, and why you honors should hold that while it's not an element per se that there will be a finding of guilt, I think that to put the burden on the government to prove beyond reasonable doubt what type of drug it is very important. And when you look at that, what happened in this case? If you look at, and to be clear, Your Honor, one of the reasons why there was no objection to the PSR in this case was a mandatory minimum that, again, was shoehorned from the verdict. And that's why it's very important. If the government cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt the type of drug involved, it's critically important, not only at the trial level, but at the plea level. Because that means when you get to that PSR and you've allowed the government without really adequate proof of what controlled dangerous substance is involved, just guessing, when you allow that, you prohibit any objection because that is a five-year mandatory minimum. You can object to the PSR. The PSR has no choice. The judge has no choice. There's a statutory minimum. That's why going back to what the government's proof is at the trial is critically important. The government's argument.
But the PSR, in paragraph 23, it attributes 28 grams to him. It's not even using what the jury found.
The presentence report, or PSR, is a document prepared by a probation officer after conviction that calculates the defendant's sentencing guidelines range based on offense conduct and criminal history. The PSR in this case attributed roughly 340 grams of methamphetamine to Gibson, driving the guidelines range to 57 to 71 months. Defense counsel points out that Gibson did not object to the PSR at sentencing, a fact the judges probe, because normally you preserve sentencing challenges by objecting. Here, counsel argues the lack of objection was reasonable because the jury had already made a methamphetamine finding that triggered a 5-year mandatory minimum, leaving the defense with no room to argue for a lower drug quantity once that finding was locked in.
It contributes 28 ounces for a December sale and a January sale, which is 58. And then another problem with these things in the government's case, the government put in 10 transactions more or less through transactions on a pay system, Cash App. And they said that those $350 transactions, 10 of them, would equate to 10 more ounces. So what you're doing and what the government was able to do is stack inference on inference on inference without proof. That's why I think, respectfully, Your Honor, that Daniels is controlling in our favor. Because what Daniels said, Daniels had that same thing in 13 years ago, in 2013, I was one of five attorneys who argued that case. And in that case, you had the same thing. You had the government saying, here are all these phone calls. Here are all these transactions. And if you look at these vague terms, a zip, an ounce, without quantifying what drug it is, and then you take this money, we ask you to find this much drug which went forward. This court found you can't do that in Daniels. This is even worse. And this case shows even more of the harm and the danger that was found in Daniels. As Your Honor notes, if the government can get away with just saying, it's an element, we put out some drug there, the jury believed it. That's not enough. The government has to go beyond that mere, we put evidence out there. There has to be concrete proof. What do you typically have? What did you have in Daniels?
I'm still a little confused, but it's my lack of knowledge in this area. I thought the government could charge a bare bones drug conspiracy, not list amount and type, and get a guilty verdict, and then we'd shift to sentencing, but you need proof. What level of proof would you need as to the drug and the amount?
Well, and Your Honor, and respect, I
that's wrong. They didn't do it here anyway. They charged meth. They charged a specific amount. The special verdict, meth, specific amount. And you're saying, let's look at the trial. So I don't mean to distract you. Your argument is a guilt-based argument. There wasn't proof that the drug here was meth.
Yeah, and Your Honor, and I appreciate your question. This is exactly why I appreciate the chance for oral argument is to have this exchange. In my view, in the way that I read this, and what's so critically important from a trial standpoint and from a plea standpoint, when that pleading is made, and there are 5 kilograms of methamphetamine that are alleged, that triggers Apprendi. And that means that the government can have a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence because that jury, if they return a guilty verdict, is finding beyond a reasonable doubt methamphetamine, 5 grams or more. That triggers that. You have to account for that when you're plea bargaining. You have to account for that in trial. And the government has to have something to prove that.
And that's your case, and that is the case presented to us, regardless of the abstract legal questions I had.
Yes.
I guess then the difficult issue for you is let's just focus on Sergeant McCormick. And he tells the jury that box is consistent with meth. Why would we have the ability to reverse that? It may seem unpersuasive, but the jury bought it.
Right. I think because when you look at what this court typically looks to in determining, is there enough evidence for the methamphetamine, particularly when you're talking about the 5 grams versus 50 grams and the purity levels, what does this court typically look to? You look to testimony from co-defendants. I was involved in this. I had other transactions. in those other transactions, then you have the lab report that shows they're 95% pure. There's something concrete that the government has proven that the jury can draw a reference, an inference from. There's something concrete that a witness can use to make a speculation. And I would argue that Detective McCormick, it's merely speculation. It could have been high-grade marijuana in that box. It could have been pills.
But why are we shifting to purity and high-grade? The issue is the type and the amount.
Well, because, Your Honor, in the methamphetamine, the type is important, and I think that that's
type,
why.
I agree. But purity level, that's purely a sentencing issue, isn't it?
Not necessarily, again, Your Honor, because
there's no objection here.
Correct. And it also, though, would be not only a sentencing issue where the government only has to prove by preponderance of the evidence. It is actually, more critically, where they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. If you look at this case, in this case, in the government, in its briefing, there was an error. And it said that Demetri Carey had sold to the third party, the third defendant. That did not occur. It was actually the third defendant who went to trial was trying to introduce a new source of methamphetamine. That was important because it showed the quantity of methamphetamine and the purity. When you take the quantity and the purity, it gets to the meeting the government's burden of proof. And that's why I'm kind of conflating the two, because it's a subpart of it. But in this case, you don't have to worry about that. You don't have any of that. You have texts, a lot of texts that sound very good, but no methamphetamine recovered from those. You have two cells, that box. No, nothing was recovered. When you do have something recovered, in this case, it's from Mr. Carey. When he is arrested, what does he have on him? He has marijuana, methamphetamine, and pills in a bag, I believe, that it's found.
Carey didn't cooperate. He didn't testify.
He did not testify, no, Your Honor. And
but we don't have an issue as to whether your client, the conspiracy count, rests on a valid agreement, right? That's not our issue.
Right. I do not think either at trial or now that there is any way to attack any of the other elements other than did the government prove beyond a reasonable doubt sufficiently to meet Apprendi, because they do have, and I think that is where it's different. They're alleging over 5 grams of methamphetamine, and that triggers Apprendi, and that triggers the proof and the reason why the jury has to find that. I think that allows me to attack the evidence and to attack whether meth was proven. Because if I can argue successfully that they did not prove and offer any evidence to show methamphetamine versus marijuana, then how can any reasonable juror, how can this court find that any reasonable juror could have found that quantity, the 5 grams of methamphetamine, sufficiently to trigger Apprendi and the enhanced sentence?
When Special Agent Jenkins testifies that the term ice in the phone call is meth, was there an objection to that, or was that unobjected to as well?
That was not objected to, Your Honor, but then what was challenged, that is part of a phone call with someone else about what he had done that day. There were 3 transactions that day, and I believe what does come out during the cross-examination, those transactions were not monitored. Those transactions were not verified later. We don't know. It's his assumption as to what took place, what transpired in that particular transaction. And Your Honor, I just...
So Carey does a bunch of deals that day. The only deal with your client is one of the 3, and therefore the intercept referring to all 3 earlier buys could have been the other 2, not your client's. That's the theory?
Could have, yes, Your Honor. Could have been.
Well, that's a good jury closing argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I tried my best with that one. I think when you look at this and you focus on that, this is a poly-drug conspiracy. There's no doubt about that. A lot of times as a trial lawyer, I have to make the argument to the jury, it could have been this, it could have been that. In this case, that evidence is here. It's there that day. It's there whenever Carey's arrested. And the government just doesn't do anything to move the needle forward. Your Honors, I see that I'm out of time. I would be happy to answer any questions you have. Otherwise, I would reserve my time for rebuttal.
Tory Roberts now begins the argument for the United States.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, Tori Roberts on behalf of the United States. I'd like to pick up where we left off with the discussion of the January 18th phone call and what that means for the transaction that preceded it. So just to provide some context, the transaction occurred at approximately 1:30 p.m., where, as Judge Higginson was noting, there is video evidence and officer testimony about the fact that Mr. Carey provided a cigarette box size package to Mr. Gibson in exchange for cash out the window of their cars. And then in the call that happens approximately 30 minutes later, Mr. Carey is bragging about the amount of money that he had already made that day. And he lists off a few things. The first thing he says is, sold a zip of ice. Then he references the fact that he collected $400 off of a debt for Bud, which the officers testified was related to marijuana. And then he also referenced selling some pills. And the officers testified that based on the wiretap, they had heard other calls that day relating to both the marijuana transaction and the pills. So they were able to tell, we heard a phone call related to someone that he was selling marijuana to, so that seems to account for that $400 debt. We heard another call with a female associate that he was selling pills to, so that seemed to account for that. And that left the zip of ice. And there was no other call that day related to methamphetamine or other transactions that they had evidence of other than this transaction with Mr. Gibson. And that was part of the evidence that the jury was able to consider in crediting the agent's inference that that, in fact, was a transaction for methamphetamine.
In pretrial and during trial, no objection to that testimony?
No objection to that testimony. That's correct. And I think you also then need to look at...
But and this issue recurs in a lot of cases, maybe even others today. Was he testifying as an expert, or was he testing on his personal knowledge of having heard the other wiretap?
He was not testifying as an expert. So there were four agents who testified, all of whom were testifying as fact witnesses. None of them were qualified as experts. All four of them were personally involved in the investigation. So you had the agents who were listening to the wiretap calls, who actually were conducting surveillance and watched both the December 1st transaction where they saw a meetup but weren't actually able to see a hand-to-hand transaction.
The panel asks whether the law enforcement agents testified as experts or as fact witnesses. An expert witness is qualified by the court to offer opinion testimony based on specialized knowledge, while a lay or fact witness testifies only to what they personally observed or know. Here, four agents testified about the investigation, including interpreting slang terms like ice and explaining that certain prices were consistent with methamphetamine rather than marijuana. The government emphasizes that none of the agents were formally qualified as experts. They testified based on their personal involvement in the wiretap investigation and surveillance. Defense counsel suggests that, without formal expert qualification, some of this interpretive testimony amounts to speculation rather than concrete proof.
And then the January 18th transaction where they actually saw the hand-to-hand transfer of cash for a package. So they were all testifying based off of their involvement in the investigation, and there was no objection from the defendant to the fact that they were testifying as fact witnesses and were not qualified as experts.
Now remind me, do they then arrest that day and do they recover the box or they never got the box?
They do not. They did not. So there was, and of course, you know, the defendant, it was well within his right to point this out, that the government could have arrested him that day. And the agents explained this was part of a much broader investigation. The indictment that was returned involved 11 defendants. And so there was a decision made, you know, because they didn't want to yet reveal their investigation, they did not actually conduct an arrest that day. So certainly the government acknowledges, you know, we could have done that and then we would have actually had the drug in hand, but that was why the explanation that was given as to why an arrest was not made that day.
On the legal question of Daniels, let's imagine, and this is not what I'm saying our panel's going to do, of course, let's imagine the government, we determined there was no proof that it was meth. Would that invalidate the conviction?
It would not, Your Honor.
Would it create a variance problem because you chose to charge meth?
It would not even be a variance problem. So what happened in Daniels, it was about quantity, but I think the same rule applies. It wouldn't be a variance because both the drug type and quantity, both of those are only sentencing elements. If you look at 21 USC 841A1, there's no reference to the type of controlled substance. And so both of those only go to sentencing. So the remedy, it would not go to guilt. The remedy would just be related to sentencing.
So your first threshold legal position is Daniels controls, since they're only alleging an attack on guilt. None of this.
And, that's right.
And you heard his response today that, in fact, it's a functional equivalent of an element. And therefore, you do have a proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Why else did you charge it and get a special verdict on?
But I think Daniels forecloses that argument. The same thing happened in Daniels. In Daniels, the charge was that it was 5 kilograms or more of cocaine, and this court determined that the government had not proved that, but that the jury's verdict finding that the conspiracy involved 5 kilograms or more of cocaine naturally included the lesser included offense of, I believe it's 500 grams, which was the lower sentencing provision. And even there, there was some discussion of the special verdict form and the fact that the jury just found 5 kilograms or more, but this court determined that based on the evidence and that finding, that it was permissible for the case to be remanded just for resentencing under the lesser sentencing provision. And the same thing would apply here. The types of drugs that were discussed at trial, the evidence that was put on, was that Carey also was involved in dealing marijuana. So hypothetically, if the court were to find the evidence wasn't sufficient that it was meth, but there was sufficient evidence that it could have been marijuana, the reason that that's important is because the penalty provision for marijuana in B1D has a 5-year statutory maximum unless there's a higher quantity, which wouldn't be at issue here. And so the remedy there, if there was an error with respect or an insufficient evidence with respect to drug type, would just be resentencing under that marijuana provision. It would not go to the defendant's guilt.
Okay, interesting. How did the PSR jump to 28?
So
charged and proved 5.
Yes. So the PSR used the cash out transactions, which I'm happy to discuss. So that's the other kind of bucket of evidence that I think is important to view as the backdrop for the January 18th transaction.
Well, let me test you on that a little bit then, because that comes up in your brief at page 22. And you think, good for you, you gave us record sites. So I tracked those down. Would it be fair to say that the cash out values, those were Carney dealing with other people? Those aren't the Gibson January 18th. You disagree?
I disagree with the first part of it. I agree that it's not January 18th. What the cash out transactions reflect, which is Exhibit 38 from the trial, those were all transactions of Mr. Gibson paying Mr. Carey. So all of those are starting from, I think the latter half of October through early January.
So it's the conspiracy, but not the substantive count.
Correct, because for the substantive count, you hear on a recorded call that day, Mr. Carey says that his cash app is not working. He speculates that the feds might be on it, and so that's why they agree to go to an ATM and have Gibson pay cash that day. But for the conspiracy count, for both the conspiracy count for understanding the quantity of drugs that were involved and for understanding that January 18th transaction, those additional transactions provide the context for why the agents concluded that they were dealing in methamphetamine. There's record testimony that the $350 that Mr. Gibson was regularly paying to Mr. Carey were consistent with the price for methamphetamine, whereas there's other recorded calls on which Mr. Carey says his price for marijuana is between $120 to $150. And so that's an important contextual point for the reviewing those cash out transactions that sometimes are exactly $350. Sometimes you have to make some inferences, and I'll talk about a specific example. So on December 1st, you have recorded calls where there's a discussion of Carey providing a, quote, whole one to Mr. Gibson and only paying $170. And there Mr. Gibson says on the recorded call, I'll get you the rest later. And then, in fact, you have 2 days later a second transaction for $158 with a note saying OU22. So the jury could infer, okay, clearly there was a transaction here. Those numbers add up to $350, and he received a zip of methamphetamine on that date. In terms of how the PSR got to the quantity, it was if you look at the cash app transactions and look at either the individual 350 transactions or ones that you add up making the inferences like I just discussed, it supports the an inference of 11 total transactions. And then you add the 12th transaction that happened on January 18th where it was paid in cash. And that's how they got to approximately 340 grams that Mr. Gibson was held responsible for at sentencing.
Were you the trial prosecutor?
No, I was not. The last point that I'd like to discuss on terms of the sufficiency of the evidence is the purity issue. My friend on the other side pointed out there was an error in our brief where we originally had asserted that the methamphetamine that was seized from Mr. Batten was provided by Mr. Carey.
The defense counsel refers to Apprendi, a principle from a Supreme Court case holding that any fact that increases a defendant's sentence beyond the statutory maximum must be found by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. In drug cases, the type and quantity of drug can trigger mandatory minimum sentences of 5 or 10 years, a floor far higher than the sentence the defendant would otherwise likely receive. Although drug type is technically a sentencing factor, not an element of the offense, Apprendi and its progeny require the government to prove such factors to a jury under the reasonable doubt standard if they increase the mandatory floor of punishment. That is why the defense insists the government must meet a high evidentiary bar, even on what might otherwise be treated as a sentencing question.
That's not right. It was not provided by Mr. Carey. They did discuss the methamphetamine. And I think the purity level of that methamphetamine is still relevant to this case for two reasons. One, in recorded calls between Mr. Carey and Mr. Batten, Mr. Carey indicated that he was interested in trying the methamphetamine from that source that Mr. Batten had. In the recorded call at Exhibit 2, he says, you know, he wants to see the quality. And Mr. Batten assures him the last time he got meth from him, it was really clear. And so the jury was permitted to infer from that this 97% pure methamphetamine was the quality of methamphetamine that Mr. Carey was interested in if he was interested in trying this new supplier from Mr. Batten. Second, Mr. Batten also said on a recorded call after he was arrested with the methamphetamine that he was planning to provide that 1 ounce of 97% pure methamphetamine to an associate of his for $375. So the jury was permitted to infer if in this same market, Mr. Batten was going to sell 1 ounce of 97% pure methamphetamine for $375, and Mr. Carey is selling his methamphetamine at 1 ounce for $350, that he was dealing in a comparable level quality of methamphetamine. And again, those were permissible inferences for the jury to make under the Rule 29 standard that we're looking at here. So even though it's right that it was not provided by Mr. Carey, it still supports an inference regarding the purity level that was at issue here. And again, given the quantity involved, it would have to be significantly diluted for this to even matter, given the quantity involved at trial. And it was a reasonable inference for the jury to make to think that when Mr. Gibson is repeatedly asking for a zip or a whole one of methamphetamine, he was actually referring to pure or close to pure methamphetamine, given that additional evidence. The last thing I'd like to note is just on the sentencing issue with respect to the mandatory minimum five-year finding. The district court did find that the safety valve applied here. That's at 627 of the ROA and then in paragraphs 31 and 75 of the PSR.
The government notes that the district court applied the safety valve at sentencing. Under federal law, specifically Section 3553F, a defendant who meets five criteria, including no prior serious criminal history and full cooperation, can avoid a mandatory minimum sentence even when drug quantity would otherwise trigger one. The safety valve allows the judge to sentence below the mandatory floor. In Gibson's case, the district court found he qualified, so the five-year mandatory minimum for methamphetamine did not bind the judge. The sentence imposed, 60 months, fell within the guidelines range, but was not dictated by the mandatory minimum. This fact complicates the defense argument that the mandatory minimum drove an unjust result, though counsel insists the principle of requiring proof beyond a reasonable doubt remains critical for future cases.
So the five-year mandatory minimum that otherwise would have applied, the district court found that she was not bound by that. The sentencing guidelines range, which Judge Higginson noted the defendant did not object to, was 57 to 71 months. And the sentence imposed was the 60 months, but it was within the guidelines range and not bound by that mandatory minimum given the safety valve finding. If there are no further questions, the government would ask the court to affirm both the defendant's conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, I think as to the variance issue, I think that points out the importance of and the reason why the government's failure to prove what drug was involved in a reasonable doubt is critical in this case. Because of Apprendi, because of the charge, the specific section that the government charged Mr. Gibson with violating is dependent on 5 grams or more of methamphetamine. Based on the arguments that I've had, based on the inability of the government to recover any drugs that were allegedly involved in this case, I do not think that they can rely on the inferences and the guesses of an agent to meet that. I think that means that Your Honors at the very least have to find that there was a conviction on a lesser-included offense, marijuana, remand for resentencing. What that does is it triggers the importance of and reaffirms the standard in Daniels that you have to have something more than cryptic or vague evidence from which a witness can draw inferences. Otherwise, judge, every time that the witness testifies about his involvement in an investigation, he can infer, well, based on my investigation, what's this? You need something else. And I think that's what Daniels stands for. And I think that's what didn't happen here. I think that because of that, and it's also doubly important here because of Apprendi and because of the triggering of the five-year minimum, what are you looking at in this case? And you ask how the guidelines and the PSR got to the 26. It got to the 26 because of the 200 to 350 grams of methamphetamine found by preponderance of the evidence in the PSR. If your honors find, which I think the evidence does support, the government didn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt it's methamphetamine, and you defer to and say a reasonable jury could have found marijuana given the concessions by the defendant, what would that be to get to that 26 on the offense level? It would be 400 kilograms of marijuana. That's the importance of the government's failure in this case. That's how the government impacts that. That's why it is critically important to hold the government's feet to the fire when it charges an enhancement, particularly one that creates a mandatory minimum. If you have, even giving the government the 340 grams of marijuana, if you find that that's what was involved in here, that's an offense level of 6. That's 0 to 6 months imprisonment. We are in a system that, one, presumes you're innocent, two, that demands that the government bear a heavy burden, heavier in a case in Apprendi whenever it's imposing that 5-year mandatory minimum. The government chose to do that here. And because the government chose to satisfy Apprendi by pleading specifically, as it had to under Apprendi, that this case involved 5 grams or more of methamphetamine, and it didn't do it, there's no recovery of any drugs. There's no cooperating witness. Mr. Carey didn't testify. There's nothing there to carry that heavy burden of the government to impose a mandatory minimum. It took this sentence where the guideline range, because there was a finding allegedly of meth, which I don't believe was met, it took it to that 5-year range. If the government had sentenced, if Mr. Gibson were sentenced pursuant to what the government did prove, which is marijuana, his guideline range with criminal history category of 2 and an offense level of 6 would be 0 to 6 months. That's what the government's evidence proved. It proved that beyond a reasonable doubt, giving the inferences that were in this case. And Your Honor, Judge Higginson, respectfully, that's something, and it's what I often don't have in trials. Again, in trials, I often have to say, well, they didn't prove it. The very person in this case, Demetric Carey, was arrested with multiple drugs. It's a polydrug conspiracy. The government proved a polydrug conspiracy. And why don't we have that proof? Counsel addressed it in her closing. We don't have that proof because the government made a decision. There was a broader investigation, and because of that, it didn't arrest Mr. Gibson whenever it saw this alleged transaction. We would know beyond a reasonable doubt what was in that box if they had arrested him. And now because the government, because of its broader investigation, didn't choose to arrest Mr. Gibson on that day, it's asking this court to uphold speculation without any other proof, without any concrete proof that triggers a mandatory minimum that changes you as a government went from a statute for marijuana that has a cap of 5 years, 0 to 5 years, that asks you to, without any sufficient proof, affirm a decision that imposed a sentence of potential sentence of 5 to 40 years. I'd ask you to find that Daniels controls here, that when you pair Daniels and Apprendi with the government's lack of proof in this case, that there is no other result than to reverse this conviction and remand for sentencing under the proper guidelines, and that being a marijuana conviction. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel.
The panel took the case under advisement and will issue a written opinion in due course. Nothing in the questions or argument predicts how the court will rule. The judges pressed both sides on whether drug type must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt when it triggers a mandatory minimum, whether the circumstantial evidence here was sufficient, and what remedy would follow if the proof fell short. A decision is expected within several months.